Folks, you have exactly 12 hours from this very moment that I am speaking. It is now 11:59 a.m. on December 1st. You have exactly 12 hours from the moment that I am saying this to head over to sunsetlakesebede.com and get 30 to 60% off all Sebede products at sunsetlakesebede.com. But more importantly, well, I think so anyways. Not only is this the biggest sale of the year that they're having, Sunset Lake Sebede and the Majority Report are teaming up to turn what is in the wake of the America's most consumerist holiday into a fundraising opportunity for a great organization. We're talking about givedirectly.org. For every 10%, I'm sorry, for 10% of every sale at sunsetlakesebede.com for the next 12 hours, only 12 hours left, you get 30 to 60% off. Any order that you get with over $100 will receive a free jar of Sunset Lake Sebede gummies. It's a $40 value. There's no promo code necessary, but here's the deal. 10% of their proceeds will go to givedirectly.org, and the Majority Report will match it. This is an organization that is fights poverty internationally, extreme poverty, by sending cash directly to people living in extreme poverty and allowing them to choose for themselves what is the most efficient way for them to deploy this money. Like I say, the Majority Report is going to match that 10% donation. As you know, Sunset Lake Sebede, majority employee-owned business, it has donated more than $16,000 this year to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, to union strike funds, conservation efforts, food pantries, and refugee resettlement organizations. You know the products are amazing. The reason why I'm so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed today, because the Sunset Lake Sebede tincture I took last night that let me sleep. Visit sunsetlakesebede.com. Take advantage of these discounts and help the Majority Report raise money for a great organization. The sale ends tonight, Wednesday night, December 1st at midnight. Also, got this email today, and not sure how to react to it, frankly. Amanda writes in, my life partner is trying to bypass my 40th to see you in Boston in January. This is just getting out of hand. She's talking about the big live January 16th in Boston at the Wilbur Theater.
January 16th.
We already announced that John Benjamin and Larry Murphy will be there. She writes, this is just getting out of hand. Yes, he's an early fan, a large contribution member, but it's my damn birthday. Because of COVID, we didn't celebrate his 40th or our 20-year F-iversary or countless other celebrations that four kids demand. Now, here we are, ready to celebrate. I turned 40 on January 14th. I decided months ago to run my first marathon in Bermuda. Fortunately, that was canceled, and we are now looking for an alternative to celebrate. Caribbean, all-inclusive, adults only? Yes, please. But no, it's a constant effort to redirect our celebrations to Boston, which we live 45 minutes from. Doesn't matter. Playing or Improv Asylum is back in action. He only keeps bringing it up because of your show playing live. I'm over it. I either invite him to watch your show on another weekend or I'm canceling your subscription. This is beginning to be just too much. And then she writes, best regards.
Well, thank you for that.
Yeah. Look, and she says, Mike's lover, not taking second to you. Listen, Mike, I don't know what to tell you. This is our only time that we're going to be in Boston. You guys are going to have to work this out. But for other people who don't have this type of dilemma, tickets are selling out very quickly. Head to majoritylive.com to get your ticket for the big live on January 6th. Larry Murphy, John Benjamin will be there. We have one or two other guests to announce, which we will do later in this week. But head over there now. I don't know if there's any more mezzanine seats at all, but balcony's great at the Wilbur Theater. All right. Speaking of a live show, let's begin ours now.
The Majority Report with Sam Seder.
It is Wednesday, December 1st, 2021. My name is Sam Seder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, economist Michael Albert, author of his latest No Bosses, A New Economy for a Better World. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court holds oral arguments in a Mississippi case that seeks to overturn Roe v. Wade. Meanwhile, the Republicans may shut down the government over vaccine mandates. Student kills three, injures eight at a Michigan school shooting. Chris Cuomo suspended indefinitely for plotting with his brother, disgraced former governor of New York, to smear sexual harassment accusers. Meanwhile, Mark Meadows agrees to cooperate with the January 6th investigation and has new revelations in his book that detail how Trump knew he had COVID during his presidential debate.
Jeez.
Meanwhile, U.S.
Man,
looks
is so good.
That fine. U.S. looks to toughen COVID testing requirements for travelers as it becomes clear that Omicron is a cat already out of the bag. Meanwhile, FDA panel half-heartedly endorses the Merck COVID pill. Dr. Oz, he of very dubious medical claims, running for Senate in Pennsylvania as a Republican. Meanwhile, Dickens wins in Atlanta, and a BLM organizer, social Democrat, or Democratic Socialist, I should say, wins the mayor in a large Atlanta suburb. Leftist Roma Castro wins in Honduras' presidential election. That is now official. And lastly, a major anti-vaccine Christian broadcaster, Marcus Lamb, dies at age 64 of COVID. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Thanks for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you could make it. Here, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. Happy hump day.
Oh, there you go. I always forget. I always forget. I forget that both that it's the hump day and that we call it hump day.
Right. Well, I mean, get used to it.
No, I'm used to it. I just forget.
Okay. Wow.
Still reeling from that email that we received, where it's really I feel
responsible for breaking up a marriage potentially.
I mean, it seems like it, or losing a subscriber. I mean, I imagine they'll probably go with that first.
Right, right.
But it remains.
Yeah, it's kind of 50-50.
I don't know. I'm getting wind of what John Benjamin and Larry Murphy might be up to at the show, and it may be worth maybe worth just sort of risking it for that guy, but we'll see. Meanwhile, the government is scheduled to shut down in 2 days on Friday. If there is not a continuing resolution passed, there doesn't seem to be any likelihood of a full year budget being passed. Of course, there are negotiations ongoing about passing a continuing resolution, but apparently there are major elements of the Republican Party that are attempting to shut the government down and leverage the idea of vaccine mandates. There's another federal judge. This one, I think, was in Missouri? Was it Mississippi?
Louisiana. Federal judge.
Which has enjoined the vaccine mandates in their circuit as well.
That was after the Missouri judge yesterday did the same. This is part of a 14-state lawsuit about the healthcare worker vaccine mandate.
Yeah, it's absurd to want your healthcare workers to have a vaccination against COVID. There's data coming out of Israel. It's very early, so you got to take this with a grain of salt. But to the there is data coming out of Israel which shows that the vaccine does inhibit Omicron, at the very least, in terms of how serious getting infected with that variant is. I don't know that there's much you can take from it. It's better than early data showing the opposite. That's the only thing I can tell you. It's not conclusive at this point. We're going to need a couple more weeks to find out exactly just how effective the vaccine is, but we know that it's certainly effective against the Delta variant, both in terms of catching it and in and the implications of it. Is it 100% effective? No. Is it 90% effective? No. 60, 70%? Maybe a little more? Yes. Meanwhile, in D.C., the Republican Party is I don't even know what to say about with them going back and forth with each other. It's really just sort of like the horrible people versus the marginally more horrible people.
Real Housewives of D.C.
Exactly. However, there are implications for when people like Lauren Boebert, but really, I mean, this is the Republican Party's been at this for a long time. I mean, there's nothing new. They have set the table and have defined, whether it's AOC, but in this instance, it's Ilhan Omar. They have set the table to demonize, frankly, women of color who are and certainly women who are Muslims in the Democratic Party. And after Lauren Boebert's most recent attack on Ilhan Omar as being part of the Jihad Squad, apparently there's some implications. And here's Ilhan Omar at a press conference explaining what those implications are. Now, we should say, warning, this is going to be a little bit disturbing because she got a voicemail.
There's some language here.
I'm going to play you a voicemail that we received hours after I got off the phone with Representative Boebert after she posted her video.
We see you, Muslim sin, nigger bitch. We know what you're up to. You're all about taking over the country. Don't worry, there's plenty that will love the opportunity to take you off the face of this fucking earth. Come get it, bitch, you fucking Muslim piece of shit, you jihadist. We know what you are. You're a fucking traitor. You will not live much longer, bitch. I can almost guarantee you that we the people are rising up and you will be tried for a military tribunal and you will be found guilty.
For those of you who did not hear it very well, let me read you what the voicemail says. We see you, sand N-word bitch. We know what you are up to. You are all about taking over our country. Don't worry. There is plenty that would love the opportunity to take you off the face of this effing earth. Come get it. But you are effing Muslim piece of shit. You are jihadist. We know what you are. You are effing traitor. And you will not live any longer. Condemning this should not be a partisan issue. This is about our basic humanity and fundamental rights of religious freedom enshrined in our Constitution.
You know what's upsetting, though, is that it's not really a partisan issue right now, because Steny Hoyer said to Axios yesterday that they're still just, quote, considering sanctioning.
I mean,
to sanction Ilhan Omar for saying that the United States and Israel had committed war crimes in passing in one sentence in a statement than they have been likely. I mean, not to obscure who the real villains are here, which are the Republicans, but the Democratic leadership in the way that they tried to capitalize on villainizing Ilhan Omar have created this environment, and they are complicit in it in many ways.
And they're also complicit in not showing the American public the seriousness of this type of stuff. I mean, I don't understand how they think from a political standpoint they're going to achieve anything with January 6th. If one of the problems of January 6th, sort of the predicate of why it was so problematic, was because you've got people like this who are in that crowd. And if you're Ilhan Omar and you're getting these type of threats, you have reason to fear for your life in that instance.
Of course.
Yeah, I think it's totally justified people were feared for their life. I think it was gross that people poo-pooed the idea. Yeah, people made fun of AOC. Like, this is the type of people that they have to worry about.
Exactly. And you cannot communicate to the American public that there was any, that you're taking this seriously, if you don't take it seriously. The American public is not going to get out ahead of the Democratic leadership in responding to this. It's just an absurd, it's shocking that they're not moving much quicker on this. And eventually, hopefully, they will.
As you say, tying it directly to the Republican Party, they keep doing these, like, individual, oh, Gosar, how could you tweet out that video? And in the proceedings of censuring Gosar, that's when the initial Jihad Squad comment was made. And then round and round it goes. I'm sure there will be another Republican that backs up Boebert here, who then gets, like, springboarded into some fundraising apparatus by having her back. This is the whole of the Republican Party. And so, like, focusing on the interpersonal drama between the call that Boebert made to Omar, it does a disservice to the entire thing that you're saying here, right? Which is, this is the Republican base. There's a reason this resonates with people. And so the Democrats never get out in front of this, and then they're gonna, you know, fall in 2024 and wonder what happened.
I couldn't agree
it's
more.
It's disgusting.
It's like
disgusting.
Gabby Giffords was like 500 years ago.
Yeah, it really is amazing.
And they lost their shit when Sarah Huckabee Sanders was mildly heckled at a restaurant.
Yeah.
Give me a break.
All right, we got some sponsors before we get to Michael Albert. Oh, this one is one of my dailies, ladies and gentlemen. You remember growing up, cereal, one of the best parts of being a kid, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Then you grow up, you realize full of sugar and a bunch of the garbage you don't want to eat. I personally have been trying to eat better trying to eat better for quite some time, but all through the pandemic, want to sort of lay off any type of sugary stuff. Healthy breakfast doesn't have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you'll love, but without all the bad stuff. One of those people who drinks a lot of protein shakes or has those protein bars, well, you can get your protein before and after workouts, or even without having a workout. Magic Spoon. Magic Spoon has 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein. That's a lot of protein. And only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. Plus, it's only 140 calories a serving. Even better, keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and low-carb. You can try the variety pack. It's got flavors like cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. And my favorite, cinnamon.
Cinnamon?
Yes. I love the cinnamon.
And cookies and cream, right?
Well, I love the cookies and cream. And also, there was a couple other special flavors they had
blueberry
that I really got into, the pumpkin chai. But that's not important. Look, go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport for your custom bundle of cereal and try it today. Be sure to use our promo code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout. Save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, the refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal. MagicSpoon.com/Majority Report. Use the code Majority Report. Save $5. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. My breakfast, and frankly, my kids' breakfast. I don't feel bad about giving them that cereal because it's not full of sugar. Meanwhile, one of the things that we do over here at the Majority Report is we sell some merch every now and then. And what powers it? Shopify. You want to scale your business? Shopify is here to help. It's got tools and resources that make it easy for any business to succeed from down the street to around the globe. Shopify powers over 1.7 million businesses, including our merch store, from first sale to full scale. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business. So upstarts, startups, established businesses alike can sell everywhere and synchronize their online and in-person sales and effortlessly stay informed. With Shopify, you can reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. You can synchronize your online and in-person sales and gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting. It's more than a store. Shopify grows with you. This is possibility, and it's powered by Shopify. I mean, I guess we'll do some maybe at our live show. But Shopify has been really great just selling our merch. Super easy to use for a small, you know, side hustle like that we're doing on the Majority Report for merch. But it also scales to much bigger selling stores. Go to Shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to Shopify.com/majority right now. That's Shopify.com/majority. And lastly, I've been eyeing a new dining room table. Not dining room table, you know, like where you have dinner.
Yeah.
My table is now 25 years old.
Okay.
And the laminate's coming off it. I decided it's time.
Laminate?
Yep. Oof. Now I'm looking at a nice table over at Joybird. I've been walking by the store over here, actually. But Joybird's selection.
We're not by a store.
No, I know. Joybird's selection of customizable furniture and modern home decor lets you bring your unique style into your space. You can choose from over 18,000 customization options or 18,000. Browse curated collections to find the perfect piece for your style. With Joybird's protection plan, your upholstery and leather pieces will look as good as new. Always. Joybird is committed to creating quality furniture and a more sustainable future. Pieces are made using responsibly sourced materials free of harmful chemicals. Through partnerships with groups like One Tree Planted, Joybird is helping conservation efforts too. With Joybird, you get quality craftsmanship, stain and scratch resistant fabrics, and limited lifetime warranty. Joybird stands by its quality with their 90-day returns. If it's not everything you hope for, send it back. I'm looking at that table, the Remy.
Really pretty stuff at Joybird.
I'll give you an update on that.
I want to, yeah. Send it to me. I need to get some new furniture.
Well, you just go to Joybird.
Well, you know.
Go to Joybird. Create a space that brings you joy with Joybird. Visit joybird.com/majority and get 35% off your purchase. That's 35% off at joybird.com/majority. All right, all those links will be in the podcast and YouTube description. Want to welcome to the program economist Michael Albert, author of his latest, No Bosses, A New Economy for a Better World. Do we have him?
I think so.
I can hear you. Oh, there you go. Michael, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks so much for coming. Let's... This is, you know, I think some of this might be, you might have to explain some of the language. This is, you know, this is, I don't know how well-versed everyone is, who listens to this, program with some of the terms here, but this is essentially your, blueprint from moving from the type of structure that we have with our economy now to one that is far more participatory, which you call Paracon. What is Paracon?
Well, first, the word just stands for participatory economy. So it's just shorthand for that.
Oh.
It's an alternative economic model, I suppose you could call it, or vision, which means to be an alternative to both what we endure here, capitalism, and what used to call itself 20th century socialism. And it has, it's not really a blueprint. It's more like a scaffold. It is five key elements which the argument says are needed if a new economy is going to fulfill the values and the aspirations we have. But a great many of the details will emerge from practice and from experience. So a scaffold on which details develop as we go along. If you want, I can you know, describe the features.
Yeah, I want to get to the features, but I first want to get to the undergirding values that set the table for this that you go through. I mean, you go through what you call, just in the first chapter alone, values for a better world. What are the values that this this scaffolding hopes to, promote?
Promote, exactly. Or make real, implement, sure. People make decisions. In any economy, there are decisions to be made. So the value regarding that we put forward is called self-management. And the idea is that people should have a say in decisions, roughly in proportion to the degree that they're affected by them. So that means that everybody is participating in decision-making and with an influence proportionate to the impact on them. A second value that we think makes sense is that people interact in economies. And so what's our value for people interacting? And the answer is solidarity, which is basically just means that people, that the economy should promote, instead of antisociality, instead of people getting ahead at the expense of others, a degree of solidarity. It should promote empathy. It should create a context in which we have civilized relations instead of what all too often we do have. Another value bears upon the distribution of stuff. How much income do you get? Income is just a claim on the social product. So how much of what society produces are you entitled to? And the usual answer to that question is that you can get income for the property that you own. We rule that out as having absolutely nothing to do with anything ethically valuable or from the point of view of incentives. Another answer is often that you get income, what you can take. Basically, for bargaining power. If you have more bargaining power, you get more income. That's very typical in our own society. Another version is that you get income for what you contribute to the social product, not what your owned thing, what you own contributes, but what you by your own activity contribute. And that one has a lot of supporters who are critical of capitalism, of leftist supporters. I don't support it. I don't believe that if you're born, for example, with, incredible capacities, Adele's voice, Chomsky's brain, whatever, you should have showered on top of luck in the genetic lottery a great amount of income. I don't see any reason for that. There's no incentive reason. And there's no ethical reason, I believe. So the value that's put forward is equitable remuneration. And what it means is that we think people should be rewarded or remunerated for how long they work, for how hard they work, for the onerousness of the conditions under which they work, if they're doing socially valued labor. So you're not rewarded for wasting your time or wasting resources and such. You're rewarded for doing things that are socially valued, but you're rewarded for duration, intensity, and onerousness. And, an overarching value, which in some sense is necessary for those or is made possible by those, is classlessness. And the idea there is that the economy shouldn't demarcate constituencies, sectors of the population, such that some dominate others, such that For example, in our own society, the owning class, roughly 1-2%, dominates everything. Or in the thing called 20th century socialism, such that a larger class, about 20%, who monopolize empowering circumstances, dominate 80%, whose circumstances are basically disempowering. That's ruled out also if you want to have classlessness.
Okay, all right, so let me just go back over that a little bit, just so that folks can digest it, because you've been outlining circumstances as they exist now, and some alternates, and then the alternate that you guys are promoting here. We should just be clear on that. So, and I want to go back through these as we walk through them.
Fine.
Let's start with the last one first. Okay. So, I think everyone understands right now that we do have a situation where we have a concentration of wealth and a concentration of power within the context of our economy, and also to some extent, and also similarly with our politics, and they're not really that distinct of an animal, as it were. And you're also saying that in the context of socialism, as it has been, I guess, practiced up to this point, or at least and theorized, that having workers' councils, for instance, are also problematic because you're concentrating the power instead of in 1-2% of people, maybe in 20% of the people. I mean, roughly speaking, right? Okay.
But there's a clear-cut reason for that. In other words, it's not that workers' council caused that. It's that the division of labor causes that. So if you divide up, every economy is always going to have jobs, okay? And a job is a collection of basically tasks, okay? So if you divide up tasks so that about a fifth of the workforce is doing all of the tasks which convey information, which gives you access to daily decision making, which increases your confidence and your verbal skills and your connections to others and so on, which is empowering. And four-fifths do work that's composed of tasks, which are disempowering, which literally reduce the information at your disposal, which literally reduce confidence, reduce ties and connections to others, separate you from access to decision making, and so on. Then the former group, even if you have democracy, so let's say you have workers' councils, and let's say you have democracy in them, or you even try for self-management in them, right? It doesn't matter in one sense. That old division of labor, and this is how institutions work, that old division of labor, by its very logic, by its structure, by its implications for the people in the economy, subverts your desire to be democratic. It subverts your desire for self-management. And 20% start establishing and setting the agendas. 20% start doing all the arguing about, the issues and deliberating over them. And 80% are bystanders, and eventually they don't even go to the meetings. And that's what happens in those circumstances. It should sound familiar for our political elections, but that's a different issue.
Yeah, and I mean, I think if you belong to a co-op supermarket, you can sort of see the similar dynamic that's going on there. There's a certain, and I guess inevitability is the argument that is going to happen.
But you see, I don't think it's inevitable at all. Can I tell you a little story?
Under that.
Oh, yeah, that's the impression. Yes, I agree.
Okay.
I don't know how much time we have. I'd like to tell you a little story.
A lot of time.
Okay, good. So I'm in Argentina 20 years ago, and there was an economic crisis, and the economy was in great, was in disarray, and many workplaces were failing, and the owners left. And by and large, so did the members of that 20%. I call that the coordinator class. So did the coordinator class. Workers took over. Workers instituted what you described, workers' councils. They instituted democracy for decision making. They leveled the wages, right? And so I'm in a room with about 50 representatives of workplaces who have done this. And it's about 6 months, 7 months after they've done it. And I'm there to give a talk. And we're going around the room at the beginning. And at the beginning, everybody's very excited and, you know, enlivened by the fact that they're in a room with people like themselves and they can, you know, who haven't met because they're from around Argentina. So we start going around the room and the mood begins to change as people describe where they're coming from and where they're at. And by the time we get to the seventh person, and it was literally the seventh person because this is imprinted in my mind. The person says, I thought I would never say anything like this. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but maybe Margaret Thatcher was right. Maybe there is no alternative. We took over. We have our councils. We implemented democracy. We made the wages fair. And now all the old crap is coming back. I don't know. Right. That's what he said. And at this point, and I'm not exaggerating here, there were some people in the room who were sort of crying because their experience was similar. And so we stopped and I said, what you mean is the alienation and the sense of indignity and the lack of control was all coming back. Yes. And I said, and you feel that's because of human nature. And a number of them nodded, and he said, yes. And I said, I want to ask you a question. When you took over and you instituted democracy and you leveled the wages, did you change the definition of the jobs at all? And at first he didn't understand the question. And I said, well, did you change the way the jobs were defined, what people were doing? He said, of course not. You know, we have to get the work done. We have to do what we're here to do in our various workplaces. And I said, well, I don't think it was human nature that caused the problem. I think it was that you maintained the old division of labor. And the old division of labor, by its very nature, right, sort of imposed the subsequent results. And so we talked about it. And I do think that's the case. I do think that that old division of labor caused the people who took the jobs that were before the empowered people's jobs, were empowered. And one last element of this. I'm in a factory, again, Argentina, same time. It's a glass factory. And I'm talking to a woman, and she's now the chief financial officer, so to speak, of this glass factory. And I ask, well, what were you doing before? What were you doing before the owner left and you took over? She says, I was working at, and she tells me the open furnace that she was working at. It was just incredible. And she described what she was doing. I probably would have lasted a day, right? And she's doing it day in and day out for years. But now she was doing this empowered job. So I said, well, what was the hardest thing to learn in this switch, right? And she didn't want to tell me. She was a little embarrassed, I think. I don't know. And so I said, well, was it to learn accounting concepts? No. Was it to learn how to use the computer? No. Was it to learn how to use spreadsheets? No. And I think I came up with one or two other things to ask her, and then I just gave up, and I said, well, please, you got to tell me. And she said, well, first I had to learn to read.
Jeez.
Yeah. So so that's one answer to the question of, are people not doing empowering things because they're incapable of it? Or is it a social? The other way I answer the question is I say, think back 50 or 60 years. Imagine a big stadium in the United States. Imagine all the surgeons in the United States are in that stadium. Look around. What do you see? And everybody tells me, I see white men. And I say, so you don't see that many women. You see very few women. Yes. You see very few blacks. Yes. And I say, what was the explanation? And they say the explanation, well, all the surgeons would tell you that it's because the women and the blacks couldn't do it. And I said, and what would a lot of the women and the blacks outside the stadium say? And they said, well, a lot of them would have said the same thing not happily, but they might have said the same thing. And I said, and could that have been the explanation? In other words, if it was true that women were incapable of doing empowering things from some genetic reason, or blacks were incapable, would it explain the situation? Answer, yes, it would. But it wasn't the case. It wasn't true. And everybody knows it. And now everybody knows it. And it's exactly the same thing. Working class people are denied and have crushed, just like women and blacks, have crushed the capacities that need to be evidenced and welcomed in order for people to participate fully.
In that instance in Argentina, I mean, because it's much clearer, like, you know, what would happen if was emancipated in terms of pursuing what they want in that stadium with surgeons, you'd have a far greater sort of diversity of who's a surgeon in that instance. But in those companies in Argentina, like, what does that look like in terms of, and I understand the concept of, you're working with a structure of the division of labor, which has been designed in many respects to disempower, people so that the managerial structure can also be employed. But what would that look like? Like, what is, if you're slicing up the labor in a different way?
Right.
Does every one of those workers who are feeling disempowered, are they doing different tasks, or how is that new structure imposed? If it is, like, what generates that?
Well, there's two parts to this question, I think, both very good. One part is, well, what's the end result? What does it look like to have a workplace which is classless, basically? That's what we're asking, right? So that's one. And then the second question, which is actually much harder, is, well, what's the transition? What is it? How do you get from where we are to there? But until you have the there in there, you can't really ask the transition question very sensibly, I don't think.
The end could be a function of the process versus.
It is.
Okay. So
it is very much, because if the process, that is the process of doing what? Of opposing current economics, of opposing capitalism, of trying for a new system. So that's the process we're talking about. If that process is blind to the possibility, or even seeing that there could be a class that is not owners, that is the new ruling class, a new boss in place of the old boss. If it's blind to that, if it says, look, there's only workers and owners, and so if we get rid of owners, we win, then it's almost inexorable, I think, that when you get rid of owners, you'll get the new boss in place of the old boss. But suppose instead you're sensitive to this possibility, and so you think that, well, how do you solve it? You solve it by having jobs, each of which is comparably empowering to the rest. And what does that mean? It doesn't mean everybody does everything. That's ridiculous, okay? So it doesn't mean that. But it does mean, I don't know, people like to use the hospital as an example, I guess, because everybody's been in one at one time or another. So it does mean that people don't only do surgery, and people don't only clean bedpans. Instead, people do a mix of things. Can you do this overnight? No. But over time, can you attain a situation where your workforce is, by its daily activities, all prepared to be confident enough and aware enough and have enough information to participate effectively in decision making, instead of 80% going home? We call that balanced job complexes, and that's one institutional feature of this thing called participatory economics.
How do you attain that? I mean, I'm just thinking about, I mean, obviously, not everybody is capable of doing surgery. That's fine.
That's okay.
There's plenty of other things in the hospital that need to be done that can be empowering besides the surgery. But how do you, is it assigned? I mean, or is it developed from
order?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's one thing to, I mean, and then this is, you know, sort of the difficulty here is the limited imagination that we have, because we're coming out of this type of of system. Like, is it every worker sort of says, like, oh, here's five choices for me, I'm going to do this one, this one, that one, or how does it work?
No, imagine a workplace. So in the current version of that workplace, you could almost ask the same question. That is, in the current version of that workplace, you apply for a job, right? That's what you do. And you get hired and you have the job. Now, the fact is, you can't apply for a job that is a balanced job. There is no such thing in the workplace. Each and every job is either on the coordinator class side, empowered, or on the working class side, disempowered. So what's the difference? The difference is that in a new workplace, the jobs that you apply for are all balanced, right? So in a, and who sets, who divides up the tasks into the jobs? The workers' council. The answer to every question, we can short circuit it. The answer to every question about who decides what's going on in the workplace is the workers' council, of course, in context of the desires of the whole population, but it's basically the workers' council. So the workers' council is deciding. So I was in a workplace called South End Press, where basically what we did, and this was even before participatory economics was well defined, right? But we sat around and we realized if you had, you know, somebody who was in charge of the finances and somebody who had the best contacts with the authors, they'd run the show, whatever else you did, even if they didn't own the business, right? Because we were nonprofit. Nobody's going to own it. So we decided that we had to figure out a way to apportion the tasks in South End Press so that they would not cause, even against our will, somebody to be elevated to dominance. It's a relatively small group. And so we had everybody doing editorial work. And that took care of that part of the problem. We had everybody sharing in things like, you know, taking the mail, answering the phone, et cetera, et cetera. And we had people all doing a particular kind of work, like, for instance, keeping the books or dealing with fulfillment. It's, in other words, fulfilling orders for books, dealing with the design of things, dealing with promotion and so on. And to a certain extent, that would change over time. But what we didn't have is, you know, people cleaning for other people ruling. It's not easy to do that inside capitalism. You have to have a whole lot of commitment to it, and you have to buck the pressure of the market and buck the pressure of banks that want, you know, to deal with the boss and so on and so forth. But you can do it. It's possible. But in a fully transformed society, and we haven't talked about other elements of this, but in a fully transformed society, it becomes natural. Right now, you don't go into a workplace and apply for a job and ask, how come it's not balanced? No one expects any such thing, right?
Right.
In a participatory economy, you go into a workplace, and if you were given a list of jobs and one of them was unbalanced, you would say, what the hell is this?
Well, then, right? This essentially vision eliminate the managerial class that has emerged in our iteration of global capitalism?
Yeah, I call it the coordinator class. Okay. It was originally called, you're right, the professional managerial class, Barbara Ehrenreich and John Ehrenreich, a long time ago. And at South End Press, we published their famous essay. And that's what got the ball rolling in some ways. It's, you don't eliminate all the tasks. I mean, some of them you eliminate because they're disgusting and worthless. But tons of empowering tasks are necessary and essential. So you don't eliminate the tasks. You just disperse them a little bit more than before so that everybody has an empowering situation. And look at one immediate implication. Right now, with 20% doing empowering and 80% doing disempowering, what does the educational system has to do? Well, the public school system, the school system literally has to graduate 20% who expect to be dominant, right? And 80% who are prepared to take orders and endure boredom. And that's what school does for 80% of the students.
It basically becomes a sorting process as opposed, yes, to a fully educating process.
Yes, and it isn't even... It's a debilitating process. I mean, the idea that the school system is to educate, it's not. It's not to educate the 80%. It's to deliver the 80% to the economy prepared to fit. And that means prepared to take orders and to endure boredom. And I don't know how far afield you want to go, but after the 60s, this became a very conscious policy.
In how did it manifest itself as I'm happy to be far afield.
Sure. Okay. After the 60s, the other side, not my side, looked and said, good Lord, this was a horror show. And we have to figure out what happened and prevent it from happening. And they established something called the Carnegie Commission that basically was investigating. I mean, it's not basically, it was investigating to discern the causes of the 60s. And it wasn't entirely stupid. They came up with one that was quite smart, I think. They said, you know, I mean, it's hard to even voice it. It's so embarrassing. They said we were over-educating people. Right. We were creating a set of people graduating from high school and entering college who expected to have a life. And when they encountered the world outside, they were more or less horrified and alienated by it. And many of them did what we saw them do. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. It's not the whole story by any means, but there's a lot of truth to it. But regardless of how true it was, the lesson that they took is that we should jack up the cost of higher education to keep, you know, the rabble out, as no one would describe the situation, jack up the cost to keep the rabble out, and much more, even more so, apportion educational resources to communities in a manner which favored the communities whose family situation was favoring this kind of confidence and this kind of expectation. And they did it. And now in the United States, we have higher education. I mean, it's incredible. Graduate school education in the United States is still very good. I mean, at the better schools. Internationally, it's still very good. But there's an interesting situation, which is that students who graduate from undergraduate education in the United States have a hard time dealing with it. And a growing proportion of the attendance at the better graduate programs in the United States is actually from overseas. And the reason for that is because so many people are stunted by education rather than flourishing. And even in the 20%, you have the problem of simultaneously giving people some tools and some confidence, but making sure that they're disinclined to use those tools and that confidence to challenge the system. So you want them to, you know, be ready to try and socially climb, not be critics.
Let's go through some of the other aspects of our economy that would change or that, okay. Let's start with private ownership. Will you also define that for us?
Sure. Because
it's not, sure. I can't own my
car. It doesn't mean that you can't own the shirt that you're wearing. Of course you own that. And it is not the case that I, because I am an avowed advocate of participatory economics, can come into your house and take your shirt. That's nonsense. What it means is society has stuff that is, we can call it productive assets. It's the stuff with which society produces the social product. And so what is that? Well, it's equipment, lots of equipment of various kinds, venues like buildings, natural resources. It's also the talents and the knowledge that have accumulated over, you know, the technology. It's also that. So instead of having this stuff owned by Bezos and company, who then use that ownership to dominate outcomes and to accrue, you know, gargantuan, unheard of wealth. Instead of that, we think of that material, that stuff, as part of a commons, a productive commons. And that productive commons is there for society to use However, to use elements of that productive commons, you have to effectively, I mean, we'd have to go further to do this, but effectively you have to make a case that you're going to use it sensibly. In other words, you're not going to waste it. You're not going to take natural resources and waste them. You're not going to take equipment and factories and so on and waste them. And you're not going to produce gargantuan amounts that offset the value. You're going to do socially valued activity. And so what we've done is we've said, let's replace private ownership. Yeah, Bezos doesn't own anything anymore and so on. Let's replace that, not with a simple idea that, you know, the state owns it, but with an idea that it's there to be used when it is a responsible, socially valuable use. And that would leave us having to explain, well, how do we determine that? But anyway, that's the criteria. And that's the replacement for private ownership.
So
final thing. What, remember you asked me about the values? How does the values relate to this? Well, when we were doing this, having settled on self-management and solidarity and diversity and equity, we then simply asked ourselves, what's the implication of private ownership for those? And the answer is, it obliterates them, right? It isn't just that it's a slight problem. Private ownership obliterates self-management. It obliterates equity. It obliterates solidarity. And it obliterates diversity. So the answer, unless we can't come up with something, we should get rid of that. And so we came up with something. And the thing that we came up with is common. That's not an unusual, you know, that's not unique to participatory economics.
What do we do with, let's say, just like restaurants? I mean, I'm trying to make this down to like a most practical.
A restaurant is a workplace, right? If you don't have the owner, then who runs the workplace? Answer, the workforce. All right, so the workers' council in the workplace, and there's an industry council, an industry of restaurants. But anyway, the workers' council in the workplace does it. If you don't get rid of the old division of labor, let's make it a big restaurant so it's more interesting. If you don't get rid of a big of the old division of labor, some of those workers are going to dominate the rest. Right. That does away with self-management, equity, et cetera. So we don't want that. So we have to figure out an alternative to the division of labor. And so that, now we've got balanced jobs that we need if we're serious about our values. I mean, if we don't care, okay. But if we're serious, then you can't retain something that violates them so horrifically. So you get rid of that division of labor. So a restaurant or an auto plant, electric auto, presumably. Anyway, a restaurant or an auto plant, same thing. Workers' council, probably work teams, divisions, and so on, making decisions via a self-managed forms of deliberation and tallying of preferences, remuneration for how long you work, how hard you work, and the onerousness of the conditions under which you work. And that is a big change, a very big change. And then, you know, the most complicated part, I suppose, is the allocation system.
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Sort of the there is an ability. I mean, there's in this scenario, I guess, or this economy, sure, there aren't necessarily markets, but there are products. And if I want a product that I have the ability to make more money by not necessarily being super skilled at something, but in terms of like exerting a easily, relatively quantifiable more effort or less effort, right? I mean, that's basically
correct.
Walk through that. I mean, so
First off, the main competitor to that, so to speak, is the view that you should get back an income that's correlated to, proportionate to, what you contribute to the social product. That's the main competitor. Most people who are progressive are not going to say you know, you should get profits, and they're not going to say you should get what you can take. You know, that's Al Capone's economy. That's what we have, by the way. Anyway, you're not going to say that. So should you get back essentially what you contribute? And when some socialists tell me that they believe that, I say to them, do you think that, you know, LeBron James or Steph Curry earning $40 million a year is overpaid or underpaid? And they, of course, say way overpaid. Absolutely. This is ridiculous. And I say, well, no, he's underpaid. By the norm that you just gave us, they're underpaid. Nike takes some of it. The owner of the team takes some of it. The TV networks take some of it. They're not getting all of it because they don't have enough bargaining power. They're getting what they have the power to take. And so that makes the person think somewhat. And then I would add, well, why should LeBron James get such a high income or Steph Curry? Because they were born with these attributes, right? Why are we showering wealth upon them on top of that? And these are values. You know, they're not, it's not a mathematical proof. I don't like that notion. So we come to this notion that you get for duration, intensity, and onerousness. And the way that looks, I mean, you're asking really good questions, and they take us steadily deeper. And so let's assume for a minute that in the economy as a whole, institutions say that our workplace should get a certain amount to apportion among its workforce as income. And income is just, I mean, that's the same concept as now, right? You get an income, and that income, you use that to get stuff you want from the social, just like now. But you're not operating in a market because there aren't buyers and sellers who are competing. There aren't, I don't know how much time you want to spend on markets. Markets are rejected because they produce antisociality. They violate solidarity because they literally produce, this is a harder argument, the coordinator class, working class distinction, even without owners, and because they misprice virtually everything. That is to say, markets are supposed to be this fantastic vehicle for societies to sensibly allocate because they're evaluating things well. Well, the truth is, and no economist would deny this, this is an irony here, that markets don't evaluate things well. Markets take into account the will of the buyer and the will of the seller. But they don't take into account, for example, if I'm buying a car, the people who are going to breathe the fumes from the car.
Externalities are priced in.
Externalities ignored. They also, by and large, they don't take into account, for example, unless I have the power to force it, my health as a worker, right? It's irrelevant, right? No. That only comes into play if a union can force it into play. So it's power, not attention to it. Anyway, the point is that if we say that the allocation system, not markets, right, can tell your factory, the three of us and a bunch of other people, that your factory is entitled to a certain amount, what's that amount going to be? It's going to be the number of people times the duration, intensity, and onerousness for each doing socially valued labor.
Okay, so let me ask.
Then inside the workplace, the workers' council is going to apportion that among the workforce.
Okay. All right. So, to be clear, just going back to the LeBron example.
Okay.
In that situation, the idea is that, and just to be clear, LeBron's getting, I don't know how much he gets paid, $30 million. Let's just say whatever, it's $30, $40 million a year. But he actually generates, let's say, yes, $100 million worth of money by, you know, everybody tuning in and going to the games and this and that.
People like it.
And he doesn't get that other $70 million that goes to the owners, that goes to the TV people, that goes to other people who are basically skimming off of that. Because, on some
level. It's also like almost impossible to quantify if he's bringing in that money and the other players are not.
We know he necessarily has to be bringing in more than he's getting. Otherwise, there wouldn't be an owner. They wouldn't be doing it. They're all trying to get their cut. what.
True.
But, okay, so whatever that figure is, but I'm just trying to say, so in this new economy, we would basically look at, like, he's playing 60 minutes 100 times a year. He's going to practice this amount, and we're going to allocate based on that number. Whatever, there's a formula.
There's a little more. He's also going to have a balanced job complex.
Okay, and he's not only going to be playing, he's also going to be, like, you know, making sure that the arena is clean or whatever it is. Everybody's going to have a piece of that. And it's how many hours you put in, and there'll be a number. But how is it determined? So, and if I put in more hours, then I'm going to go get a car, or I'm going to get two cars because my family wants two cars as opposed to we want a bigger house, or we want more clothes. But how does society organize? If there's no markets there, how does society say this is the value that we're going to allocate to a basketball team, or this is the value that we're going to allocate to car production? So there may be 5 or 10 or 100 different car companies, and they're all going to put out cars. But how do you find that equilibrium if there is no market?
Can I ask you one question? Do you have any economics background?
I don't.
You're asking better questions than 90% of economists would ask. And I'm not just saying that for you. It's true. Okay? I mean, you're asking straightforward. All right. So the answer to that question is you have to have an allocation system, right? And an allocation system is something which, by some fashion, right, accumulates information from consumers and producers and generates what the economy is going to do, how much of this and that is going to be produced and where it's going to go, and simultaneously prices things. Markets do it by competition and get the prices wrong, but they do get prices, and it does function. There's no point in denying that, right? It functions. Central planning does it by essentially the following. It's as if you send a questionnaire to everybody and you get back some answers. You look at those, you send another questionnaire, you get back some answers, you send orders and you get back obedience. Okay. That's the model of central planning. Participatory planning doesn't have a center like that. So what is it? Well, we said we have workers' councils and we also have consumer councils. So you're in your household as a consumer, but you're also in a neighborhood and there's a consumer council because a lot of consumption is collective. And then there's federations. Like, there's a federation of workers' councils up to an industry. There's a federation of consumers' councils up to a county or a state or whatever, because a lot of consumption is collective. In our society, most collective consumption, we don't even know that it's happening, right? We have no say in it whatsoever. In a participatory economy, you do. Okay. What's going on? What allocation then is, it has to be some kind of a dialogue between workers and consumers, some kind of a conversation. In which workers are basically looking at their situation and saying what they want to do. Consumers are basically looking at their situation. This includes sort of an estimate of what's going to be your income for the year, because you know how much you want to work, et cetera. So they're looking at their situation and essentially seeing what they want to consume. This information has to be interact. Right. So each side has to hear from the other. And when it hears from the other, it has to modify what it's requesting. And what we want, what we hope for, is it's called an iterative procedure, is a round of such interactions in which you arrive at a plan. You arrive at a level of synchrony between consumption and production that is doable and that you can proceed with. And you arrive at prices, valuations that are take into account the full individual, social, and ecological costs and benefits. This is ideal. And so if you can do that and then you know, the remuneration is important because the remuneration affects how that occurs. But the case is that this process, with a few jobs, right, that facilitate it, processing the information so it's readily accessible, delivering what are called indicative prices. That's guesses as to what the final price will be, right? So in the process, you're hearing indicative prices that represent where we're at in the iterations, right? And then you're reacting to those, and those prices are getting closer and closer to actual true social costs and benefits. And the demands and supplies are getting closer and closer to each other. And with slack and so on, you arrive at a plan. And so the question becomes, is this possible? A long time ago, actually around when Robin Hanel and I, who with whom initially this was sort of worked out, were doing it some years earlier, a guy named Alec Nove, who was a socialist, wrote a book. And in the book, he said, look, there's markets, there's central planning, and that's it. There's nothing else. That's the way the cookie crumbles. And so you either choose one, you choose the other, or you choose both. And what we were saying is, if that's the way the cookie crumbles, we're in hot water, because those allocation systems both subvert the values we hold dear, and produce outcomes of the sort that you see in the United States and you saw in the old Soviet Union. So we thought, well, let's not take it as gospel, because this guy says it. His proof was nothing. His proof was basically, I said so. I mean, literally, you can go back and read it for yourself, right? There's no real proof of it. And so we sort of felt like, why? Why is it impossible to have not just an individual buyer and seller being oblivious to everything else competing, or a planner and everybody else obeying? Why is it impossible to have the producers and the consumers have a process which is facilitated by structures and which lets them exchange their information and arrive at a plan? If a plan, by the way, isn't like a binding decision over the course of a year, it certainly changes. Circumstances change. There's a hurricane, whatever. All sorts of things can happen. Tastes can change, right? So you have to be able to keep updating it also. The claim is No Bosses presents it. That's the book, I guess, you know, that got me on here.
Right.
So No Bosses presents a description of this process in more detail than we can do right now. And there are other presentations that do so as well. I guess what I would say for your audience is this. Nothing that I've said should cause you to jump up and say I'm a participatory economy advocate. Right. But what I would hope it would do is cause you to say, hell, I hope he's right. I hope it really is possible to have an economy in which there's dignity for everybody. There's equity for all. People control their own lives. I hope that's possible. And this guy is saying that a structure and just a few defining pieces, five defining pieces, make the case. I want to look for myself. And think this through. I hope people will say that. And that's how the book's written. It's not written for economists. You know, it's not written in some arcane language. You have to spend a little while thinking through things because they're so foreign. But it's not rocket science. It's not biochemistry or quantum mechanics. It's real life stuff that we are all familiar with.
Well, we will put a link to No Bosses, New Economy for a Better World. I never thought I would say this, but it's a third way that I can get behind.
There's a third way. That's true.
Economist Michael Albert, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Like I say, we'll put a link to No Bosses in our podcast and our YouTube descriptions.
I thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I meant what I said. You don't need to hear this, but it's Let me give you one. I was once in Turkey, and I was on a show like this, and it was a except that it wasn't like this because it wasn't. It was a key figure in Turkish media, you know, like Dan Rather type level of figure, not radical at all. And I was flabbergasted by how good his questions were and how this was a long time ago after a prior book. And when I came back, I asked Chomsky about it because we're friends. And he said, it's not surprising. In the United States, the need to be sure that powerful media figures are in line. And that's people on NBC and ABC who are, you know, TV, whatever you call them, you know, the people on the screen, the Sure. Morning America, et cetera, et cetera. The need is so great to be sure that they don't step outside the norms, right? During the Vietnam War, there isn't a single instance, not one instance, of a main newspaper, not a radical one, but a main newspaper, or a main TV report, or a main radio report that said U.S. invasion of Vietnam. The phrase could not be uttered. Hmm. And the people didn't utter it, not because somebody was there to be sure that if they uttered it, they were fired. They couldn't utter it because they couldn't think the thought. They literally couldn't think the thought. And so Noam's point was, look, in Turkey, they don't have to do that. And this guy thinks he hasn't been so socialized and so battered by the process of climbing the ladder in the Turkish media that he no longer can think those thoughts. But people in American media, by and large, are who rise to the top. And that's why things like the Majority Report is so important.
Well, I like to think we're doing okay around here, but yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thank you so much
Thank
for coming.
You. All right. Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. He doesn't realize we're so awash in Comcast money.
I know, I right? And anything. Google money.
And Google and Comcast money. I didn't want to say anything, but... folks! It's your support that makes this show possible. And, of course, the Google and Comcast money that we're
Thank
drowning
you,
in.
Thank you, Google and Comcast. Members, you're okay, too.
Yes. And it is our members that make this possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget, Majority Live, January 16th. The big live.
The big live, yeah.
You can go to majoritylive.com, get your tickets. Better do it quick. We're breaking up families around here. Broken family. Why'd you folks break up? Because of the Majority Report.
Right.
Because of the Majority Live show. Check that out. Also, don't forget, we got some merch. If you want to buy a Christmas present, shop.majorityreportradio.com. Or I guess a late Hanukkah present.
Yeah, right.
You'd have to get it quick. You could put a picture of it. That's sometimes what you do.
Or a birthday present. Who
or a
knows?
Birthday present. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, tonight we got Paul Prescott. He was a Jacobin contributor. Now he's running for the 8th State Senate District in Pennsylvania. We're going to be talking to him about labor and progressive organizing, as well as why Democratic voters shouldn't accept pro-charter school candidates, and how we can organize for green jobs. So that's tonight, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the postgame.
Folks, see you in the fun half, 646-257-3920. We'll be taking your calls and getting your IMs, which you can get. You can IM us through our app at majorityapp.com. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.